bundle of it, put it on their heads, and they started walking away. And then they found another sort of street in the village, some hemp and thread, which had already been woven into rope. And so one of them thought, well, you know, like, what do you want sort of this hemp for anyway but to make rope? So he threw down his bundle of hemp and just put the made a bundle of the rope. But the other guy said, no, no, I've already sort of carried this hemp so far already, I might as well keep the hemp. And so the two of them went along, one had the rope, one had just ordinary hemp. And then after a while they found some cotton. And the one with the rope said, well, cotton's more valuable than rope. He threw away his cotton and threw away the rope and picked up the cotton. The other one said, no, the hemp is just, I've already carried it so far anyway, and it's okay, I'll just keep that. And as the story went on, they found not just cotton, they found cotton cloth, they found like silk and silk cloth, they found some, copper, and then some silver, and then some gold. And one of the guys, all the time, when he found something better, he threw away the old stuff and took up the better stuff. This old guy was so accustomed to carrying his hemp that when he got back to the village, one of them had a big pile of gold on his head and the other one just had a big bundle of hemp. Isn't that the case with us? And the Buddha told that story. He said, like, the one of them was very popular with his friends and relations, while the other one got into big trouble. What are you fool for? Just, you had a chance to pick up some gold, which was worth something, and you just carried this bundle of hemp. Isn't it the case with us that instead of actually changing for something better, we just keep to our old habits, we get accustomed to our old views, because we're used to them? You ever try talking to like an old person about changing their views, and they say, no, I'm just too old to change now, I'm just too accustomed to this way of looking at things, too accustomed to change my ways. We all got a bit of that old age in us. It's being stuck. So sometimes we get to, you know, a particular layer of that lotus, and this is good enough for us. Thank you very much, this will do. And we never really get the full benefit of this type of meditation. So you have to be prepared. If you're going to do Satipatthana, if you're going to do insight, if you really want to know the way things truly are, you've got to be prepared to throw away an old bundle of hemp which you've been carrying around for years. You've got to be prepared to throw away the bundle of rope, the bundle of cotton, the bundle of cloth, the copper, the silver, for when you find the gold. If it's something better, something more true, then throw it away. Why keep hanging on to these things? So you have the courage to let go of old ideas, to go one more petal in on the lotus. And that courage is important in Satipatthana. That commitment to truth rather than commitment to comfortable ideas. When you actually focus in then on any of these four things, I was just saying on Vedana, pleasure and pain, the other ones is on the mind, consciousness, you may have some very comfortable ideas of what consciousness is, which you're very used to, you want to preserve. If you have comfortable ideas of what consciousness is, what you are, what God is, what the world is, what anything is, and you're not willing to abandon them, then not much of the lotus will open up. It will only open up as far as you're comfortable with. You will not be able to see things newly, freshly. And with the mind objects, things like, you know, the willpower, which you can put in front of your mind. What is that? Or any other objects which you can focus on. To actually understand these things. Thought, what is thought? You put that in front of your mind as a mind object. You have to sustain attention on it without getting involved in it, because if you get involved in thought, then it just carries you away. You've got to stand back as if it's someone else's thinking. Stand back as if you're watching thought on a movie screen. Always remember, you're on a seat. You're not in the movie. You're just standing back watching. Getting that perspective with Satipatthana. If you don't get that perspective, you need to dive into the lotus, you just become another leaf in the lotus and it obstructs the truth. You've got to sort of keep that perspective, standing back. And if you do with any of these four objects, these four focuses of mindfulness, you sustain your attention on it, there will eventually come a time when you get past your old knowledge. That is the most important stage to sort of get over, because it gives you the courage, it gives you the encouragement, I should have said, to sort of carry on, because this is where it starts getting fun. You start to see things you never expected before. The Dhamma starts to open out, it becomes fascinating, it becomes fresh, it becomes wonderful, full of wonder. What is wonderful is usually things which are uncommon, things which you've never seen before. Isn't this amazing? Well, I never expected this before. I never expected this. This is where the wonder aspect comes into meditation. And say, just when you watch the carpet, look at the carpet, it becomes actually wonderful. Wow, I never expected things like that to exist in a carpet. Or on a leaf on a tree. When you actually do this, it becomes fascinating. This was in that poem by William Blake, "To see a world in a grain of sand, a heaven in a wildflower, hold infinity in the palm of your hand, and eternity in an hour." Really sort of inspiring, that poem, which I'm sure that some of you have heard of before. Because I've said it so very often. If you haven't actually read it yourself, you've heard it from me. To see a world in a grain of sand, something insignificant. A heaven in a wild flower. You know, wild flowers are very small. A whole heaven, just enough bliss in there to keep you happy for eons. A simple wild flower. And then you get hold infinity in the palm of your hand. Wow, infinity. In that palm of your hand, right here and now, you've got infinity. Endless. Boundless, this present moment, an eternity in an hour, timelessness. Wow. You see, the whole of existence is opening out to you. A grain of sand is just opening up into a whole world. A little wild flower, a whole heavenly realm is in there. You know, the present moment is infinite. You think it's so small and tiny. That's where infinity lies. Than eternity, timelessness, right now. The whole thing opens out, what you'd never expect. And so, if you can actually get to that wonder stage, then the whole practice of Satipatthana gets really to be fun. Investigation doesn't become a challenge anymore. It becomes an invitation. It becomes, as we chant, Ahipassiko, inviting you to come and see. That's in that chart we do every morning and evening. You know, the Suvakata Dhammo, Bhagavata, Sanditiko, Kaliko, Ahipassiko. Inviting you to come and see. Inviting inwards. So the Dhamma is actually, once you get past the stage of being afraid of abandoning your old bundle of hemp, then it starts getting really interesting. Wow, I've got some silver now. Wow, some gold. Look at this, some diamonds over there. Wow, it's something even more expensive than diamonds. Dhamma. You see all of these things, and it becomes really fascinating and really good fun. So this is why, once you start to sustain attention, you can open up that lotus. And the innermost leaves are the most beautiful. That's why they become fascinating. They become strange and wonderful. They become things which only you can see. It's hard to describe to somebody else. You just don't believe that sort of a carpet could be so wonderful. Instead of using a carpet, I used to talk about concrete. Because when I started doing this in Thailand, the sala, the meditation hall, was just had a concrete floor. And, you know, we do walking meditation up and down this concrete floor. Until, because of samadhi, the concrete floor started to explode into colour and shape. And it became just so beautiful. I never believed that concrete could be so wonderful. And I give that simile very often over in Melbourne once on a talk. And the following day, one of the people who heard this, he was invited me to dinner at his house. And he took me to one of his walls. See that? And he had a bit of old concrete put in a frame and hung it on the wall. He'd heard my talk the night before. He found a bit of old concrete round the back and he framed it. He said, "You're right, it's really beautiful." So instead of going and getting all these expensive prints and Alan Bond's La Promenade and all this sort of stuff, it's cost a fortune, just go and get a bit of old concrete from around the back of your house. Frame it, put it on your wall. I'm sure it'll be a conversation piece when you get your friends around. And you say, can't you see it's just so beautiful? So wonderful. You're just on the outermost petal of the lotus, mate. You think concrete is ugly. Who told you that? Why do you assume that? It becomes like a little teaching to tell them how to get deeper. So with the Satipatthana, what you're doing is sustaining attention on one of these areas of like the body, like this Vedana, the mind or consciousness, the conscious objects. You do that long enough, then surprise, surprise, it's beautiful, it's wonderful, and it's tremendously empty. The whole body just starts to disappear. There's nothing there. Now, even like when you're meditating, you sustain attention, and just the body disappears. It's gone. It's nothing. Look at your breath. Sustain attention. It just disappears. Look at the doer. Sustain attention. And it disappears. Even Samadhi Nimitta. Sustain attention. And it just disappears. So it's amazing, like vanishing aspects to experience and to reality. You look at the carpet. The old carpet disappears and reveals a new carpet underneath. The outermost petals just vanish. And that becomes one of the beautiful experiences in meditation. Noticing the vanishing of phenomena. Things end. They're not constant. And this is the impermanence which I really like to stress. Not just rise and fall like a pendulum going to left to right, the ball is always there. Not like sort of a wave going up and down, but the water's always there. It's not just like movement. It's like existence and non-existence. Breaks up the continuity illusion. That's what anicca is supposed to do. And once you break the continuity illusion, then non-self becomes just so clear. Just no way can you hold on to that self anymore. It becomes obvious. That was something you added onto reality. Just like frogs being sort of not tasty or frogs being delicious. Actually, frogs are neither tasty nor delicious. It's just what you add on to it. The mind. Mind objects. Vedana. Or the body. So what you add on to it makes it mind, makes it a self. And that's where the problem of suffering lies, said the Buddha. Once you see that illusion, once you see that fundamental mistake in the way you look at the world and view the world, then the whole universe changes for you. You enter the street, Sotapanna. The whole thing changes. And with it, a whole heap of suffering disappears. That's why anyone who's seen the Dhamma is usually quite happy about it. They don't become miserable. People just think it's miserable. If you find out there's no one there, just what a depressing thing to experience. That's why I remember there was a cartoon, so I should have cut it out and kept it, of a Blondie cartoon in the papers. You may know Blondie cartoon. And Dagwood. And Dagwood actually, in this cartoon, is actually sitting meditation in his office. And, you know, in his American office, and his boss, this really cynical, sharp talking, quite sort of cruel boss, came in with his cigar and said, "What are you doing?" And Dagwood said, "I'm trying to find myself." And the boss said, "I wouldn't do it if I was you. If you found yourself, you'd be terribly disappointed." Sometimes we assume if we really, this is like the negative character, if we really found who we really are, we'd be sort of, quite depressed about the discovery. It's best than perhaps not to know, but that's not the way it goes. The thing is that if we really find out that there's no one in there, and imagine, it's not what you imagine will occur. Actually, it becomes such a relief, such a freedom. Oh, thank goodness. I don't have to worry about me anymore. I don't have to care what people say about me anymore. I don't have to live up to all these ideals of people anymore. I don't have to achieve anymore. When you've got like a strong feeling of self, you have to justify yourself. You have to be someone. You have to be a good meditator. You have to be a good person. You have to be jovial, charming, beautiful, wonderful. If you're an I, the self, it really is no one in there. It doesn't matter anymore. People can call me whatever they like. I don't mind because I'm not here. I don't have to. I don't have to live up to any ideals. You know, I'm not here. So in this way, you find that through the realization of non-self gives an incredible amount of freedom. So often, that which has really been stressful for you in your life, a great burden, you'll find is all connected with the illusion of self. Now the problems people have these days with lack of self-esteem, worrying about themselves, worrying about what people think of them, worrying about how they come across, worrying about how they're doing in life, how they're doing as a monk, how they're doing as an abbot, how they're doing as a meditator. You had a really good meditation retreat so far? Are you feeling complete and utter failure? How often is it in life you feel utter failures? It's marvellous if there's nothing there to fail or succeed. It doesn't matter. You'll be completely at peace. You find that suffering can't touch you because there's nothing for it to touch. It's the freedom of that realisation. The freedom of suffering from seeing the root cause there. It's the illusion of a self. So this is at the Satipatthana and how it works. And it needs to have that prerequisite of powerful mindfulness and the ability to sustain attention, which is what we call samadhi. You apply it to any of these four areas and just see what happens. But be willing to suspend all of your old ideas. Be willing to see something new. Have the courage to throw away all your old bundles of hemp if you really want to see the beautiful priceless Dhamma right there in the centre of your lotus. So that's the talk on Satipatthana today. Anyone got any questions or comments? Okay, the thoughts of emotional states which come up in the mind in Western psychology, in Satipatthana they become the fourth of those focuses, the mind objects. So if it's anger, it becomes like a mind object. And if it's like depression, it becomes a mind object. So basically you just watch anger or you watch depression, but from a distance. Like Ajahn Chah, you know, if you get really angry, sit down, put a clock in front of you, and see how long you'll be angry for. What that actually does is sort of externalizes the anger. And it, you know, you're actually watching the anger as an object rather than getting right involved in it. There's a difference between watching a movie on the television and always knowing it's a movie and never crying when sort of you get, you know, never get right, really involved in a movie. You know, when the alien comes up on the screen, never jumping, never sort of putting your fingers over your eyes because you don't really want to see what's going to happen next. Not gripping the sides of your chair. But that shows that you have got lost your perspective. It's a movie. That's all. So maybe why do we do that? Because we think it's fun. Because we want to get involved. We want to be a bit scared. We want to sort of cry. We want to get emotionally involved. It's just like a substitute for real life. And actually, I remember one person said that real life is not all it's cracked up to be, so fantasy is not that bad. However, that's not the way to go. So anyhow, that if you can actually look at these emotions, or what in the West we call feelings arising in the mind, look upon as mind objects, but with that sort of stand-backishness, so you externalize them and they become mind objects. One of the hardest ones to watch of those is the third Satipatthana, the citta, the consciousness. Because so often if you watch something, you know, it becomes an object rather than the subject. So here you've got to be very careful and just to observe the process of consciousness rather than objectifying it. It's like being with it, gathering the data, seeing how it changes, allowing it to open out and manifest its reality to you over a long period of time. Just like the carpet, you think you know what carpet is. You put consciousness in the front of your field of attention. You observe it and see just consciousness manifests as true reality. Not what you think consciousness is, not what you've been taught consciousness is, not what you believe consciousness is. All of that are outermost petals. So allow it to really manifest its true nature. Does that make any sense? Well, actually, no, because that's just too complex. That way you're sort of externalizing it. Where you watch consciousness, have a guess where it is. It begins with J. There we go again. That's the only way you can really sort of get a handle on consciousness. When you're watching it sort of without objectifying it for a long time. One of the other things about Satipatthana which I should have said, which is important to understand the whole sutta if ever you read it, is that mindfulness doesn't always take this moment as this object. Very often mindfulness takes the last object as its object of contemplation. Something arises, and then you watch it. It's actually already gone. And it's important to notice that, because you can even be mindful of just something which happened 10 minutes ago, half an hour ago. Especially when you get into jhanas, you might take that experience as an object of your mindfulness after it's already gone. Mindfulness also includes recollecting, reviewing. That's why, if those of you who know the Satipatthana Sutta, one of my little sort of missions is, I haven't seen anyone yet translate literally when part of the body mindfulness, the kaya nupassi, or rather the kaya satipatthana, the focus of mindfulness of the body. They have a section of the different sort of postures and the different sort of states of moving, sorry. And they got of walking, sitting, of stretching your hand, going out, coming back. And they have this word sute, which literally means in sleep. And everyone, even Bhikkhu Bodhi, translates it as falling asleep. And if you know Pali, that's not the word they use for falling asleep. They say they're mindful of falling asleep. Actually, literally, the word means mindfulness in sleep. You're mindful in sleep. How can you do that? It's actually impossible. You can't be mindful in sleep. It's one of those oxymorons. But if you put it like mindful on sleep, you take the sleeping state as an object of your mindfulness once you've woken up, not at the same time. And it's that aspect of mindfulness which can look upon something just past, which can take that as an object. When you develop powerful memories based on samadhi, you can actually be mindful right now of what it felt like when you were a kid. I mentioned that the other day, completely mindful of being in your pram, even though that was 45 years ago. The experience comes up, you can put your attention on it. Remember past lives, the experience of that life comes up. Not as a vision, not as an idea, but as an experience. your mindfulness is on it. You attain a jhana, such a powerful experience, afterwards you put that jhana right in front of you. Mindfulness is right on it, even though it's past. You take that as an object of your contemplation. So satipatthana also includes sort of using the past experience, especially the powerful experiences, as an object for developing wisdom. Satipatthana and perception. Okay, yeah. Satipatthana on perception. It's a moot point here whether in actual satipatthana, I usually say that perception is included under the fourth satipatthana as an object. But actually, I like to really include it under that third one as an aspect of conscious experience. Just actually see how consciousness works. Because actually you're looking at the functioning of consciousness. Especially in jhanas. I mean, this is where you understand how like perception can be just so powerful. And it can be just so variable. It's just so malleable, perception. You know, you can look at a wall and you can see it as beautiful, you can see it as really ugly. Anyone can do that. You know, it's the old simile of like a glass of water, half full or half empty. But you know, the difference could sometimes be immense in its consequences in people's lives. Same experience, just what you add on to it. But after a while you can see red bricks as blue, black bricks as white. It's amazing just how powerful perception can be. But what is really fascinating with perception is knowing that just how it's just so malleable, so soft, that if you really want to go through life and live a reasonably happy life, that you can choose to be happy. You can choose to be sad. So much of the suffering which you put in life, which you experience in life, is just what you've added on to it. Basically, it's your fault. You're doing this. You can undo it if you like. That's why I tell people sometimes when they've got cancer, enjoy your cancer. That's what you're talking about. It's all right for you to say that. A person can actually do that. I only tell people if they've been meditating a long time, they understand what I mean by that. You can do the impossible. That's what perception can do. It becomes like the trick behind psychic powers. So changing your perceptions. And it becomes one of the most important faculties for developing jhanas. Because what you're doing with jhanas is developing certain perceptions, holding on to them, sustaining them. Very fine perceptions. You know the one I tell about the beautiful breath. It's such an important part of learning jhana meditation to be able to see something like a beautiful breath. If you suggest that and you look for it, you'll find the breath is beautiful, and then you can keep with it, and it gets very wonderful. If you don't make even that suggestion, then a lot of people can do breath meditation for years and never see the beautiful breath. It's amazing just how perception is suggestible. And once you know how it's suggestible, you can make your own suggestions and get into beautiful perceptions. So you see like the where perception is coming from, and just how conditioned it is, how it lacks like true reality, true substantiability, how it is empty. You can make it anything you want, basically. And how much do people believe in their perceptions? That's a problem with life. We perceive a fog to be sort of taste awful, and it does. And there, I proved it, it does taste awful, I told you so. How could anyone eat this? I know this is going to hurt. And it does. So one of the people in the monastery, he's got terrible teeth and he keeps on going to the Walpa Dental Hospital. They know him now because, you know, the first time he said, I'll just pull it out, no anaesthetic. they can't do that. And so they did it, and they did it once, they know sort of you don't need anaesthetic for this person when they pull his teeth out. Could you do that? If you say no, then you can't. You're making your perceptions already. What happens when you even think about going to a dentist and having your teeth pulled out without anaesthetic? It's going to hurt. I know it's going to hurt. This is going to be terrible. I know it's going to hurt. That's why it hurts. You're constructing perception. And sure enough, because you construct it that way, when you take the teeth out, it does hurt. Yeah, I'm right. So the perception becomes self-fulfilling. A lot of people, they can go to a revival meeting and they can get experience God, or they've seen Jesus Christ, they've heard it. And you try and convince them, they haven't. They said, I perceived it, it was there. And look actually what actually happened, because they went there and they really wanted this to happen. All their mates were experiencing all of this. And the sort of the priest at the front there was, come on, come on, you can do this. And so they want it to happen. And they perceive it in that way. And it's self-fulfilling again. So much of perception we actually create. We don't see us creating it. And once it's created, we experience the life in that particular way. And it's self-fulfilling. Yeah, I was right. There is a God. There is Jesus. There is a Buddha, there is the ultimate person, is all these people. How can it be all these people? I could never really figure out why people have believe in all sorts of different religions and not my one. That's how they did it. Because the perception becomes self-fulfilling. As you want to perceive it, so it becomes. It's the same in science as well. You see that all the people who aren't rebels in science, who sort of follow the same old ways, that they actually find what they're looking for. They get their theory, and then they always prove it. Doesn't mean the theory's right. Just means the perception. So that the way they created the perception comes true, and there it is. Self-fulfilling fantasies. So actually that's how you can look at how you can discover perception. It can be fascinating. It's such a fundamental part of our existence and we take it for granted. You know, the policeman says, did you really see that? So yeah, I did see that flying saucer. Yeah. Were you really abducted by aliens? Yeah, of course I was. I perceived it was true. Were they? Who knows? I don't know. But the point is that their perception has created the reality. And we just believe in it. Don't think these people are stupid. Don't think these people are crazy. They're exactly the same as you. It's the way we depend upon basic perceptions. Not realizing that these are being constructed. That takes a lot of grounds for knowledge away from us. Because so often we say, yeah, you know, I've been to Paris, I know what it's like. You know, I've been here, I've done that, I've experienced this, I've experienced that. Doesn't matter, that can still be all wrong. Completely misperceived Paris. No, you're nice and free, you can perceive anything you want. You don't have to know anything. Except impermanence, unsatisfactoriness and unself. You also should know that now's the time I should stop talking and do some interviews. Keep going too long. So thanks very much. If you've got any more questions, maybe put on a piece of paper for tonight. And now it's time for interview time.